Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
We maintain the peace through our strength. Weakness only invites aggression.
Trust but verify.
Well, I've said it before and I'll say it again. America's best days are yet to come.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
This is Reaganism, a podcast where we explore the principles and values that guided our 40th president and where we explore where the Reagan movement resides today. I'm Roger Zackheim, host of the podcast and director of the Ronald Reagan Institute here in Washington, D.C. Today, we're honored to have an especially important guest who has played a fundamental role in shaping the American political landscape over the last few decades, Mr. Ted Olson. Ted first appeared before the Supreme Court nearly 40 years ago. He's argued 60-plus cases before 20 different justices, close to one-fifth of all justices ever serving on the Supreme Court. He has won over 75% of those cases. Ted first came to Washington, D.C. as an assistant attorney general in charge of the Office of Legal Counsel under President Reagan and Attorney General William French Smith. He later served in government again during the Bush 43 administration as Solicitor General. That is the lawyer who argues before the Supreme Court on behalf of the president. Time has listed Ted as one of its 100 most influential people in the world back in 2010. Some of the most impactful and important cases he's argued include Bush v. Gore, Hollingsworth v. Perry, which was a case over gay marriage. There's an amazing documentary worth watching about Ted's involvement in that case called Case Against Eight. Many other cases, and for our football enthusiasts, yes, he even was involved in the Tom Brady versus the National Football League case, otherwise known as Deflategate. Important for us here at the Reagan Institute is Ted's service as a trustee with the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute. The foundation, of course, is the parent of the Reagan Institute based out at the Reagan Library in Simi Valley, California. In addition to Ted's remarkable career, we're especially pleased to have Ted on the podcast today because he was the driving force behind a recent Reagan Institute event where we celebrated the life and legacy of Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, the first female Supreme Court justice, and of course, President Reagan's first nominee to the Supreme Court. We hope you enjoy the conversation. Welcome to Reaganism. Today, we have an amazing opportunity to have a conversation with Ted Olson here in the law offices of Gibson and Dunn. Welcome, Ted.
Great to have you. Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So we're going to jump right into it and look at a piece of your professional life, perhaps is explored less these days, but consequential to us here at the Reagan Institute, and that is your time in the Reagan administration. Obviously, you served as the Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel. Some refer to it as the President's Law Firm. I would just love to hear for a couple, a minute or two, just reflecting on your time in the Reagan administration, even before that, perhaps, your relationship with William French Smith and how you got into the Reagan world.
I love to talk about that. William French Smith was a partner, was a young lawyer at Gibson Dunn in Los Angeles. And when I started with the firm, I had always been involved to some degree in Republican stuff as a college kid or as a law student. And when I came to the firm, I wanted to continue that in my spare time or help out with Republican campaigns and so forth. William French Smith was a major figure in the Republican Party in California, and he was a major figure at the Gibson Dunn Law Firm. He was a senior partner. So I went to him soon after I joined the firm, which was in 1965.
So you didn't have a relationship with him before that?
No.
Oh, wow.
So I came to the firm, and I was a young lawyer, and I learned about who he was, and I knocked on his door, talked to his secretary, and she let me into his office, and I told him that I was interested in helping out on Republican things, and he was very, very gracious about it. He said, absolutely, we can send you out to do this, give speeches, participate in various different ways. You know, political campaigns are always looking for eager young volunteers.
Yeah. Particularly free labor.
Yeah, that's right. And lawyers, you know, because you never know when something's going to come up. And so Bill Smith sent me out the next day to give a speech about campaign finance to a bunch of corporate executives. I said I didn't know anything about it. And he said, you can learn it real fast. It was a lot simpler than it is now. Right. At any rate, over time, Ronald Reagan had developed a core of individuals in California who were called his kitchen cabinet.
Yeah, and French Smith was part of his kitchen cabinet, right?
Yes, he was. And so, and we were doing legal work for the Reagans. We did their tax returns, we the law firm. And Bill Smith did some, whenever a legal issue came along that the Reagans needed help with, he helped out. And soon after our relationship developed, I started being the person that he would assign to take care of problems involving the property or problems involving the children or whatever. So I got to know the Reagans during that period of time when he, you know, got to be governor of California for 8 years and run for president and so forth. To bring you up to more close to the time that we're talking about, is that I was someone that became someone that the Reagans would trust. And when he was elected president, I spent some time at the convention in 1976, which was an unsuccessful run. And then
when he challenged Ford in that contested convention.
Exactly. It was very dramatic and it was very close. But he lost out to Gerald Ford. But in 1980, the convention was in Detroit and he was successful. He was the nominee. I did some legal work at the convention, which I won't get into, but then he was the person elected that November.
So you, this kind of entry into the Reagan administration, I mean, the pathway was there early on from your time at Gibson Dunn.
Yes, and so when President Reagan was elected, they had to put his financial affairs in order, and they had to do various things to transfer from California to Washington, D.C. I did a blind trust. I created a blind trust for him so he and Mrs. Reagan could put their assets in a blind trust. I came back here and worked with the Office of Government Ethics to do the blind trust. And then, of course, he was inaugurated, and I was appointed to be an assistant attorney general for the Office of Legal Counsel. So I moved my family to Washington, D.C. to be in that office in the Justice Department.
So one more question before we move on to something that we had an opportunity to collaborate with you on a great event for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor celebrating her. But before we go there, the type of work you were doing with President Reagan or Governor Reagan at the time, and then OLC, that's a dramatic change. What was that like, kind of coming into the Justice Department and being presented with all the weighty policy and legal questions that come before the desk of the lawyer leading OLC?
The Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department is only about 20 lawyers, but it's one of the most important legal offices, probably the most important legal office, maybe aside from the Solicitor General's office, in the government. The office answers legal questions and gives legal opinions on the toughest legal questions that come to the government, constitutional questions and things of that nature, and the opinions of the Office of Legal Counsel are binding on the government. So it is a very, very significant responsibility. It was a great deal different than anything I had done in private practice, but I loved it. The people there were great. The lawyers were terrific. And we were dealing with tough constitutional questions involving the framing of the Constitution, of things of that nature. So it was very exciting.
And pretty critical to someone like President Reagan, who came in with very defined views in terms of the size of government, the role of the administrative state. I mean, there was an ambitious agenda long developed in his mind from his time as governor, and OLC had a key role in seeing that realized.
President Reagan was maybe one of the most qualified persons to ever be president because he had studied government, he'd studied our society, he'd gone out and given speeches all over the country on factory floors and to communities and so forth. He knew the people, he knew what his ideas were, he was very firm about what he stood for and the principles he stood for, but he didn't know much about the federal government. So it was very helpful. He wanted his administration to be honest and straightforward. He wanted the proper legal advice to assist him in implementing his policy judgments, which were, in some respects, big changes, cutting down on excessive regulation and things of that nature. And it was helpful to have legal opinions that helped guide the way to do those things.
Validated and allowed it to happen. Obviously, a very consequential moment in President Reagan's term in office was his first nomination to the Supreme Court, which was historic because it was the first woman on the Supreme Court, Sandra Day O'Connor. We had the opportunity, really led by you, to celebrate her career in this fantastic event we held in the Library of Congress in September on the anniversary of her confirmation, or swearing in, I should say. Just for a moment, reflect on where you were and your role in that historic moment where the vacancy emerged and the discussion within the White House and, of course, the Justice Department focused on who President Reagan was going to nominate.
President Reagan had stated during the campaign that if there was a vacancy on the Supreme Court, he wanted to nominate a woman to fill that position. There had been, up to that point, 102, 103, I don't know the exact number, justices on the Supreme Court, not a single woman in history. And he was determined to do that. And when the vacancy occurred in 1981, the first year of his presidency, he was determined to follow through. There were people that were advising him, were suggesting, well, you said that, but, you know, there are lots of other
campaign
people.
Campaign promise.
Yeah, don't worry about that. But he was determined. He had made that promise. He believed it was the right thing to do, and he was going to vindicate that promise. And so various different people in the White House and the Justice Department did a little bit of a search, did some research as to who might be available. To make a long story short, they settled on Justice O'Connor, who was then a leader in the legislature in Arizona.
Right. And she had been nominated to the Court of Appeals in Arizona as well, right?
And so she had been a top of her class at Stanford Law School. She'd been a practicing lawyer in Phoenix and other parts of Arizona. She'd been in the legislature. She'd been in the court system. So she was very well qualified.
And not many women had those set of experiences.
Very few did. Time. There were a few female judges at various different points in the federal system and in the state court system. But Justice O'Connor had a very unique background and experience because she had been in a state legislature. She knew how politics worked and how legislatures worked and how people, the give and take of politics, but she'd also been a judge and she hadn't been a federal judge, but she was still very, very well qualified and she was extremely highly respected. She had grown up on a big ranch in Arizona.
198,000-acre cattle ranch.
That's right. And so she had dealt with the cowboys, and she'd been out in the field fixing fences and doing things like that. So she knew how to handle herself.
She could handle the good old boys in the state legislature.
That's
that was good
right.
training for it. I want to hit briefly on politics and the judge. But you know, one of the things that you read about this moment within the Reagan administration was – at least the press was trying to tease out a difference between those who wanted to let Reagan be Reagan, you know, the true conservatives, and those who wanted Justice O'Connor. And I don't know to what extent that narrative is accurate, but people have written about it. In your judgment, was Reagan being Reagan when he selected Justice O'Connor? Was that letting Reagan be Reagan?
I certainly believe it was. He had the conviction that someone who was a woman should be on the Supreme Court. He thought it was about time. He was very impressed with her background and her experience. He liked the fact that she was a Westerner, that she had been gone to school in California.
Rode horses.
And horses, yes, absolutely. And she turned out to be exactly the right person for Ronald Reagan to appoint. Now, people that had different points of view, that's always true in every administration. But Ronald Reagan knew what he wanted, and he was going to, in the nicest possible way, he was insistent, and he felt that she was absolutely the right person, and she certainly was, because she could handle herself, she learned the job, she had a certain level of humility, and she was someone that everybody liked. She had a wonderful, engaging, accessible personality.
Well, that came out in our event, which we're going to get to in a second. But you hit on something when describing Justice O'Connor's biography and her time in politics. And there's a lot of people who say we got to keep the judiciary, you know, Article 3 out of politics. And there's reason for that. But I almost heard in your comments earlier that her experience in a legislature and being a leader in the legislature in Arizona, in some ways, qualified her uniquely to be a judge and ultimately a Supreme Court justice. Today, I don't have to tell you this, you've argued before all of them, many of our justices to rise to the level of being a Supreme Court justice can't have a deep background, a lot of experiences, because in one way or another, it would disqualify them. They wouldn't get through the confirmation process. Could you just opine for a minute about perhaps the qualities and the experiences that Justice O'Connor had by being an elected official made her a unique and perhaps a consequential justice?
I think that's absolutely right. The fact is that she knew how to deal with people. She knew how to deal with people, stubborn people, people that were resistant to ideas, people that couldn't get along with one another. She knew how to cajole or to push out the ability for a consensus. She agreed. She felt strongly about congeniality and getting along with people, but she had a way of dealing with people. And having been a member of the legislature, having sought elective office, she knew what it was all about. So it wasn't that she was a partisan. It was that she was aware of how politics worked in American life, that it's necessary for people of conflicting views or competing views to come together to get things done. So she applied that same ability when she was on the court. She was able to bring justices together to write legal opinions that would be have the force of law.
We're going to get to that point about collegiality and talk a little bit about the remarkable panel which you led with Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg. But before we do that, I want to read to you something you said in your opening remarks for that event where we celebrated Justice O'Connor, where you were charging everyone who would be on panels that day. And you asked everybody to think about how, you know, O'Connor developed into the ideal jurisprudential pioneer to be the first of her gender to sit in the Supreme Court, what it was like for her to break the barriers that she so enthusiastically overcame, and what she has done for America, the Constitution, and the American people. That's what you charge everybody to talk about. And I think they responded by really answering those questions. But I was always curious about what your take was in terms of what Justice O'Connor did for America, what she did for the Constitution.
Oh, she did so many, Justice O'Connor did so many things for America and for the Constitution. But first of all, she was the first woman. It was 200 years in our history, 220 years in our history, and not a single woman had been a member of the United States Supreme Court. Think about that. What does that signal to the American people? Half of the population are women. They're thinking, well, that avenue is foreclosed. That's closed off to us. Well, she was a perfect pioneer. I think of a little bit like Jackie Robinson was the first African-American to be in Major League Baseball. It's very hard to be that kind of a pioneer because everybody's looking at you as a symbol. And every single mistake or every single incident that occurs, people can criticize. And so she had to break the barrier. She knew she was a symbol. She knew she was someone that women would look up to. And yet she had to be a justice of the Supreme Court and make decisions that not everybody would agree with. Half the time, or not a good segment of the time, the decisions of the Supreme Court are 5-4 or 6-3. There are divisions on the court. But she was able to handle the relationship among the people, but also she was a great emissary. She would go out and give speeches. She had more energy than anybody I can think of in my life. She would give a speech in Kansas City, then she'd be in California, then she'd be in
Remarkable, how much she did.
China or someplace else, or in Europe with the effort to provide opportunities for the emerging countries of Eastern Europe when they developed democracy.
Post-Soviet Union, absolutely.
And so she was there. She was all over. And when she went places, she was extraordinarily gracious. She had this smile. She would talk to people. She would be available and accessible.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that really came out of that event, and we'll link to it for those listening to the podcast and like to see the recording of this celebration of Sandra Day O'Connor, one of her clerks, we had a number of the clerks, as you referenced earlier, when Den, he opined that she very easily could have become a governor of Arizona, then been on a national ticket and become the first president of the United States. And he said that kind of earlier in the day, and it really kind of was thought-provoking. But as you heard the other clerks, and they talked about what you just described, Ted, this person who was a great mother, her sons were there talking about that, who embraced a role as a Supreme Court justice, they were like the first couple about town, you know, engaging all the thought leaders and influencers in Washington. And then, going around the country. I mean, this was someone who was beyond just a remarkable justice who was impactful on the court, but truly was one of a kind.
Absolutely. And she reached out to people. And when people reached out to her in return, She engaged with them. She was cared about the justice system. She cared about people. She cared about young women. She cared about teaching civics in school because she felt that that wasn't being done much anymore. She wanted to help European countries develop an independent judiciary. She was engaged all the time. So she worked hard on the court. She was always there. She never missed a day, as far as I know, anyway. Snowstorms, whatever. She was the first one to show up. She was a remarkable, resourceful, inexhaustible person. She
inexhaustible. Just, that definitely came across. I want to turn now to the actual, what I thought was the highlight of that event, and that was your conversation, as I mentioned, with Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg. And pretty unique. Well, not unique for you to be in conversation with the justices, but perhaps the stakes a little bit lower than normal. But I just love to get your reflections or takeaway from that conversation you had. Like, it was almost about an hour on stage, engaging with them in this, you know, kind of informal atmosphere, and you know, with about 300 of your closest friends in the room and everybody watching on C-SPAN. What were your takeaways and thoughts kind of after having that pretty unique discussion where they were reflecting on their relationship with Justice O'Connor?
It was a thrill for me. I always enjoyed talking to Justice O'Connor, and occasionally I interviewed her. Justice Ginsburg was the second woman appointed to the Supreme Court. Justice Sotomayor was the third person and the first Hispanic woman to be appointed to the Supreme Court. They were also pioneers. Justice Ginsburg is a warrior. She fought for women's rights from the beginning of her career. She was among the first in her class at law school, first in the college. You know, she was a pioneer, and she led the fight for women's rights and equality for women under the law. Justice Sotomayor was a prosecutor and a defender and a federal trial judge and a federal appeals court judge, and she's another pioneer. So the opportunity to talk to them, to have a conversation with them and just ask questions and let them talk about their lives and their experiences and their opinions was a thrill to me. And I think everyone that was in the audience that talked to me about it thought that that was great, just to hear them in their own words talk about their experiences and what it was like, what it is like to be a justice on the Supreme Court of the United States.
Yeah, I mean, just as one person in the room listening, my reflection is we don't hear from them enough in that way. Probably good reasons why people want to keep the justice away from the microphones outside of their work on the court. On the other hand, Sandra Day O'Connor, and it was a big proponent of civics, that the justices have a role to play in promoting kind of a civic-minded society. And certainly Justice Sotomayor is taken up that mantle by continuing Sandra Day O'Connor's work with the iCivics organization. I want to turn to one clip from that event where Justice Sotomayor is describing her conversation with Justice O'Connor the morning after her induction. So we're going to play the clip, and then I'll ask you a question following.
First morning after my induction that I was there, she came to visit me, which I was humbled and said to her, I was going to try to come see you. And she said, no, you're a new justice. I'm welcoming you. But one of the things she spoke to me about was my obligation to attend the lunches that the judges had. And she told me she had told the chief that it was his obligation to continue the tradition. So it continued even after her taking senior status and leaving the court, that emphasis on the institution.
So we just heard Justice Sotomayor say that Sandra Day O'Connor kind of was emphasizing the institution of maintaining not just the collegiality through these lunches and engaging with other justices, but the sense of its importance in our society. I wonder if you might just reflect on that and what that means to you and the importance of that.
Well, to think about it, that the Supreme Court renders decisions in 60 to 70, 75 cases a year. They're all exceedingly important. They touch our lives in every way. The criminal justice system, equal protection under the law, the rights of persons when they're arrested and they deal with law enforcement. These are the free speech, everything. Those decisions affect everyone, and sometimes they're unanimous, but sometimes they're sharply divided. But those justices live in a small community. They have clerks, but they basically talk to one another. And to the extent that those divisions, those sharp divisions in a particular case carry over to the next case, that would be unhealthy. The fact that they would have lunch together and that they always shake hands with one another before they come to sit on the court during oral arguments is that collegiality and a sense of respect for one another carries over into their opinions, even when there are sharp divisions. And when they talk to the public, I've heard almost every justice say they get along even though there are sharp divisions between them in controversial cases.
Scalia and Ginsburg would probably be the best example of a personal friendship, yet deep ideological.
That's right. Justice Scalia was very conservative. Justice Ginsburg is very much on the other side of the political spectrum. Yet their families were very close friends. They would go to the opera together. My wife and I were invited when they had New Year's Eve, just those families together. And they respected one another. They listened to one another. Justice Ginsburg famously said when asked why she was so close to Justice Scalia, she said, "He makes me laugh." And then Justice Scalia asked the same comparable question, said, "She makes me a better justice. She tells me where she thinks I'm wrong, and I go back and I think about that, and I make my opinions better." That kind of relationship is very important, but that kind of relationship, what Justice Sotomayor was talking about, that's an example for the rest of society. We're in a very sharply divided political time in this country where opinions, you can't go to a dinner party without someone getting angry with one another, with the other people there over some political issue. It's important that if we have different views, that we respect one another as individuals and get along with one another. We're a part of the same country, a part of the same culture, a part of the same society. We need to remember that, and we need to behave accordingly.
That's a great message, and you were just referencing the tradition of the justices prior to oral arguments, and you're someone who has participated in one or two oral arguments before, and would love to hear you reflect on what it's like arguing in front of the Supreme Court. You've done it so much. You had a couple this session, and you know, there was one clip which I like to play where Justice Ginsburg actually was talking about how the justices look at oral arguments, and I'm going to play it here and love to get your reaction to that as well.
Justices are asking the advocate questions, but they're really talking to one another. Is that
you
true?
You know that feeling that you are being talked through and not to.
So how do you like being talked through and not to? And how do you use that to advance your client's interest?
I don't know, quite understand what Justice Sotomayor was thinking when she said the advocates should let us do that more, because we do what they say. They ask the questions and we listen to them. When you're arguing before the court, each side gets a half an hour typically, and you will be interrupted by as many as eight or the justices during an oral argument in that 30 minutes. I've been interrupted 60, 65 times. But they are speaking to one another. They haven't talked about the case much among themselves. So when they form opinions about what the case is going to means when they're having an argument, they're sort of making their arguments to their colleagues through the form of the questions.
Because until that point, they've just done it through memos, correct? That's
right, and a little bit when they decided to take the case or not. Mm-hmm. But basically, they're not talking to one another. And they don't even really exchange memos before the oral argument. So you'll get a question like, well, don't you think that the answer is this? Or what about this point? And they're thinking about the potential opponent over on the other side of the bench, and an advocate has to understand that that's going on. Mm-hmm. You immediately stop speaking as soon as there's a voice coming from the bench, and then you try to answer their questions, and then you try to cycle back to the arguments that you're trying to make. And what you're trying to do is you have to respond to their questions because it is a dialogue. This is a great opportunity. Some people don't like to be asked hard questions, and they sort of not comfortable during oral arguments because it's an extension of the Socratic method that we're all taught in law school, where the professors are asking hard questions and probing and so forth. But when you're getting questions like that, you're learning what's in their mind, what's on their, what concerns them. And if you can't respond to those questions, you're not going to win the case. You might not win the case anyway, but you've got to be able to understand where they're coming from. And this is an opportunity. If you got up to give an oral argument and you didn't, and they just sat stone-faced and looked at you, it'd be very discomforting, at least if you're used to that kind of process, because it gives you an opportunity to expand on what you're saying. And then maybe you're answering Justice X's question and making a pitch to Justice Y.
So it really is high stakes. I mean, you've obviously written the memos and the case has matured to a certain point by the time you're up there for oral arguments, but there's still quite an opportunity in that setting to shape the outcome. That's what I'm hearing.
You're hoping that you can shape the outcome. They have read the briefs from all the parties, and they've read briefs filed by organizations called Friend of the Court briefs and so forth. And they may have made up their mind, but you always have that belief that this is your opportunity to shape the way the decision's coming out. Maybe shape it your direction, or at least shape the kind of the opinion that they write that is least unfavorable if it's going to come out against you. But you have an opportunity to focus the court on the question before them in the way you perceive the question. And you know, it's conventional wisdom. If you can define the question, you can win the debate.
Right.
So you're trying to shape the way the justices perceive the case. What does it mean to society as a whole?
Craftsmanship, certainly. Let's talk about one of those cases where you argue before the Supreme Court and highly consequential. I'm curious to kind of get you to reflect on what that argument was like, both going into it and then when you argued, and that was the Bush v. Gore case.
Well, the Bush versus Gore case, many people remember it as 5 weeks of contentious debate with respect to the outcome of the 2000 presidential election.
Hanging chads.
We were in Florida, and the outcome of the count of the vote in Florida was going to determine the outcome of the election because of the Electoral College system. And the outcome, when it ultimately came out, was a one-vote differential in the Electoral College. I was representing Governor Bush against Vice President Gore. We felt that the process that was taking place in Florida was unfair, unequal, and changing right before our very eyes. We thought the Constitution required the intervention of the Supreme Court to set things right, to make sure that the rules that existed at the beginning when the votes were cast were the same rules
consistent
applied
and fair, yep,
when they were being counted. There were other arguments on the other side, of course, but we felt that the difference in one state can change the outcome of a presidential election. So it is, people would say, oh, that should be up to the people of Florida. It should have been up the Florida legislature and so forth. But when you realize that if you can tilt the balance in a close election in one state, it might be Illinois, it might be Louisiana, it might be California, you can change the election. Mm-hmm. So it's important that the rules be understood and that they be applied fairly and that they be applied consistently. So we argued that to the United States Supreme Court. And fortunately for our client, Governor Bush and Mr. Cheney, the outcome was in our favor.
In that, and we'll go one more case and we got to wrap this up. In Bush v. Gore, of course, on the opposing side, the counsel was David Boies. And I'm curious, how was he as the opponent? And at what point, I think you've commented on this publicly, you may have seen this, did you realize, hey, I'd like to team up with this gentleman because he's doing a pretty good job arguing on behalf of his client too?
David Boies is an extraordinarily good lawyer, and he is exceedingly effective at going to the heart of a matter and explaining a complex legal question in very simple terms that anyone can understand, almost syllogistically. If thus, therefore this, you know, and you sit and listen to him, you think, my gosh, he's really good. And he's really a very talented individual too. And I did think during the time that we were arguing together that 5 weeks was so contentious for the whole nation. And our clients were, of course, had a great deal at stake, the presidency of the United States. We became close friends. After that, we share a love for French and California wine. And both of our wives are lawyers, very talented individuals in their own case. And we got to be friends. And then we decided to work together. We thought if we had an opportunity, how forceful it could be if we were on the same side as opposed to opposite sides. So we did come together to
in Hollingsworth, right?
Pardon?
In the Hollingsworth v. Perry case.
Yes,
right?
It was. That's the name of the case. It's Hollingsworth versus Perry. Perry is one of the people that we represented, a gay couple, two gay couples actually in California that wished to get married. The California Constitution prohibited marriage between anyone other than a man and a woman. These were gay people, thousands of gay people in California, tens of thousands that wished to get married to the people that they, the individual that they loved, and they were being prohibited by the California Constitution from doing so. We felt that that was wrong, that it was a violation of the protection given by the Constitution to the individual and individual rights and liberties. So we came together to challenge California's Proposition 8. We took it through a trial court, an actual trial, several appeals to the Court of Appeals out in California, and then ultimately to the United States Supreme Court. And David Boies was a part of the team, and we worked very, very well together. It was a pleasure to work with him.
And a consequential question, you've commented publicly that in your long and accomplished career, this case was highly consequential to you.
Oh, very, very consequential, because you look in the eyes of the people that you were representing and you were taking them out of the category of being discriminated against or putting in a being put in a separate category and saying, if we win this case, you will be treated as equals in California. You will be able to get married. You will be able to have a family. You will be able to become a part of a community. You won't be considered as other. You won't be considered as objects of discrimination, because if your California Constitution makes you separate, it makes you unequal. And so looking in the eyes of the people that we were directly representing, but the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people all across America that we were indirectly representing,
so this is the Constitution of California you were arguing, correct? I mean, this was limited to California.
We were arguing that the California Constitution prohibition was violated the United States Constitution. And ultimately, that was the outcome of the case. And these individuals were permitted to get married. And you could see in their faces, and there were 34,000 children of same-sex couples in California at the time. It gave them legitimacy and equality and dignity under our United States Constitution. It was only two or three states that permitted same-sex marriages when we started it. By the time we were finished, all 50 states.
Right. And of course, one can't do anything consequential in their professional life without being attacked. You had been victim of that in your career before taking on this case, but you're kind of on an island when you were doing this. This kind of came across in the documentary about your role, about the case, but being a conservative and so therefore being somewhat suspect by the LGBT community. And then in the conservative world, people wondering, well, how does this fit in with Ted Olson's kind of position as a leader in the legal conservative community? How did that impact you?
Well, if you're going to be involved in consequential cases, you're going to be exposed to people that disagree with you, and some people make it personal. And it can be kind of contentious and nasty. Once you've thought things through and you've listened to people of other points of view, which we do and try to do, once you decide that you're on the right side of a matter of principle, then you have to be able to take that. And you're not going to be any good as a warrior, a gladiator, an advocate on tough legal questions if you're too sensitive and if you're too bothered by criticism. So you have to, that goes with the territory. It's, as I guess it was Harry Truman said, you know, if you don't like the heat, get out of the kitchen. We feel.
If you want a friend to wash and get a dog?
Yeah, that's right. Anywhere it helps to have a dog. But that happens from time to time. And you just have to, one of the things we did is we tried to convince people that marriage between people who love one another, who want to be a part of the community, who want to form a family, who want to live down the street and have a bank account, pay taxes, have a home, run for office, and so forth, that's a conservative value.
So I want to press on that, and then I want to move to one more case, and we're quickly running out of time here. But I asked you about kind of what it was like as a professional just to deal with the incoming, all the critics, and this one really put you in a position where you're getting it from both sides. But what's as a conservative, if a conservative came to you and said, explain to me why you took a conservative position in that case. What you were just starting on that, I interrupted
you.
I wrote a
long piece that was called The Conservative Case for Gay Marriage. It was on the cover of Newsweek, and it was, I don't know, 3,000-4,000 words. And to explain the point that, A, we respect individual liberty. We respect keeping the government out of people's lives to the extent that we can when there is not actual harm. No one could explain how it was harmful for two men or two women.
That was a key moment of that oral arguments where the opponent really had difficulty responding to that question.
The judge said, well, what harm would there be if California allowed two gay women to get married and have a family? And our opponent said, I don't know. But that was the consistent answer from people. Well, it's not going to cause other heterosexual people to not get married or to have children or to have families or anything like that. It was, well, it's always been this way. Well, we don't really accept that in this country. It was always this way to have children of different races segregated in schools. We had a constitutional provision in many states that prohibited interracial couples from getting married. It's always been that way. Well, it's not anymore. Witness President Obama's mother and father. So I wrote a long piece explaining why it was a conservative value to allow people who loved one another not to exclude them from society, but to include them from society. People wanted just the same thing that the rest of us did. They wanted to have a family. They wanted to be respected. They wanted to have personal dignity and personal privacy and personal freedom and so forth. And you talk to gay people who've gotten married, and they're indistinguishable from you and me, in my opinion. They are the same kind of people, just that they have a different orientation that has to do with the immutable characteristics of the way they are born or the way that, you know, their genetic makeup is. I don't know the answer to all of that.
Right.
But to respect those individuals, I say it's not a liberal or a conservative value. It's an American value of equality and dignity.
Well said. One case that was controversial at the time to one that you're involved in right now, certainly no shortage of consequential and perhaps at the time controversial cases, but the DACA case is one you recently argued before the Supreme Court, and it's the deferred action in childhood arrivals and the Dreamers. Decision's not out. I'm sure you're waiting every day, but tell us a little bit about your role in that case and kind of how the position of your client kind of complements your own personal outlook.
Well, the Dreamers are individuals who came to this country when they were children, some of them 1 year old, 5 years old. They have no understanding or familiarity with the country from which their parents or their families brought them. We can't, they're here. Technically, they're illegal. They're undocumented. I shouldn't say technically. That is the law. And we could send them back to some country they've never really...
Yeah, the executive has that authority.
Yeah. And so the idea was that people... That if we can't deport everyone, we can... The Congress appropriates money to deport 400,000 people a year, and there's 11 million people who could conceivably be deported. These are the last people in the world you want to deport. They didn't violate the law. They were brought here by their parents or families or something like that. In order to be a part of this program, you have to be vetted, have, you know, investigation, have not have committed any crime, be in school or be in the military. These are people that are very, very valuable parts of our society. And America is the only place they've ever known as a country. And so they're the last people in the world that we should think about throwing out. So this program that President Obama initiated gave them an opportunity every 2 years to renew this status where they'd be permitted to work so that they're going to be in this country.
Right, remove the uncertainty.
We should want them to work so they can support themselves and their family. make society take care of their livelihood. And they're very, very good people. And when I was approached by, would I represent them in the Supreme Court? I thought, yes, I should, because to change that rule and expose them to the risk of deportation, take away their right to work, take away their right to have the families that they have, and then threaten them with being removed to a country that they don't know anything about. They have no family there. They have no relationships there. That is insane, it seems to me, and it's cruel. And I think that given the resources that we have to enforce the law, these people should be protected. And so I thought that was the right argument to make in the Supreme Court.
So I was on the other side of this debate at a forum, perhaps less prestigious than the Supreme Court. It was at the Zach Heim breakfast table earlier this morning with my four daughters. They were taking your side, but I tried to make an argument about executive authority, and you know, President Obama had his executive order, and you know that's something that his lawyer said he had the authority to carry out, and now President Trump has his kind of authority to remove that executive order, replace it with something else. Didn't convince my 14, 13, 10, and 5-year-old. But there is an element here which sounds kind of legal in argument, less with the kind of principled arguments you make, where, you know, this is something that unless the Congress has acted, right, the president of any administration can choose to deal with it as he or she wants.
Well, that's true. The president, this president, or any president can change that order with respect to the Dreamers. They have the power to do that, but they have to do it right. They have to give explanations. They got to justify, well, we know that we've changing the status of these people that has existed now for 7 years. It's going to have consequences. It's going to hurt people, the people that they work for, the communities that they're in. It's going to hurt their families. We have to, at least as a government, saying we have the power to do this, but we have to be rational. We have to be thoughtful. We have to explain why we're doing it. Our argument was that the Trump administration just said, well, the previous program was illegal, so we're just going to do it. We're not going to take responsibility. We're saying the law makes us do it. We thought that was a bad, unjustified explanation, an insufficient explanation. And so you're right that the government has the power to execute the laws as it sees fit. But there should be some judgment here. If we can't deport 11 million people, Congress won't appropriate that money. So who should we deport? Should we deport someone here that came here when they were 2 years old and now they're 16 years old and they have a job or a future or they plan to go to college? Why would we deport that person rather than someone who's committed crimes, reckless driving, abusive husband, drug convictions, sticking up banks, or whatever it is? We've got plenty of people that should be deported first. So our immigration policy has limits because of our resources and the number of people here. We have to be rational and respectful about it and obey the law and do it thoughtfully. So I'm with your daughters. But you have a legal point, but I think they have a point that has a lot to do
with
conscience.
Real quick on that, and I want to go to our lightning round reflecting on that most recent oral argument. Did you get that feeling that you're being talked through and not to?
Well, definitely the justices are split in this case. We argued it on November 12th.
Sure.
There won't be a decision. We don't know when there will be a decision. It could be next June. It could be earlier than that. So we just have to wait and see. And I expect and I understand that different members of the court will have different views on this. I don't win every case, and I don't win every justice, even if I do. So it's in their hands. We did our job as conscientiously as we could. We explained our case as strongly as we could. It's up to them now. And we all accept the decisions of the Supreme Court.
Lightning round here, focused on President Reagan. Reagan enthusiasts will be interested in your answers to these questions. What is your favorite book about President Reagan?
Well, my favorite book is, well, two, his autobiography, where he writes about his own life, an American life. It's a marvelous book, and I will put that in the same category as his diaries. You know, he kept a few paragraphs every single day of what happened that day. And he was pretty objective about it. I mean, he went to this and he did this and so forth. And he was very careful. He was very kind, even people that he may be opposed to politically. He was very kind and he was cautious about his language. But what comes through is the decency of the man, his thoughtfulness when it came to taxes and the control of government and things of that nature. It's in his autobiography and it's in his diaries. And those two things tell you more about him than some of the other books that have been written about him.
Go to the primary source is what I'm hearing. Favorite speech by Reagan?
Well, I was thinking about his speech because we're right now in the days of the anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Mm. And he did a number of major consequential speeches that affected the world, including the Evil Empire speech, which we know now from people that were in the Gulag in Siberia. They heard that speech and they were amazed that a president of the United States would call it out. And it made a difference to them and their spirits. But tear down this wall?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it really, no one thought that that would happen. And it did. And we're in a different world today because of that. And there were people that didn't want him to say those words. He was going to do it because it was in his soul that he wanted to send that message. And he knew the consequences of his words. And so when he said it, people all over the world listened to that.
It was in his soul. We had an event with the Bush Foundation. That's George Bush, Bush 41, and Peter Robinson, who helped write that speech, basically made the same point that this was who he was and it was inevitable he was going to say it. Do you have a favorite Reagan quote?
Well, there's a zillion favorite quotes from Ronald Reagan, but one I used in a speech just within the last week or two is he talked about immigration and immigrants, and he talked about the fact that America was unique. He said you could, and I'm just paraphrasing, I don't have it in front of me, you can go to Japan and move to Japan and never become Japanese. The same with Sweden or Norway or another country, Saudi Arabia, you can never become an Arabian or a Swede, but you can come to America from any of those countries, anywhere in the world, and you can become an American.
Let's leave it at that. Ted Olson, thank you so much for taking the time to participate in Reaganism. We look forward to doing more with you in the future and having you back on the podcast.
It's a pleasure. It's a great thing to talk about Ronald Reagan.